I'm up where I normally meet along with Beaver, but there are some folks currently at the information desk that are not as familiar with the exact spot and may have had you park in the junior high lot. I didn't get permission from the principal to park there, but this time of year you won't have any. East Cemetery Hill, and in the early division were the brigades of Avery and Hayes. Hayes, Louisiana troops were more over to my right where your cars are parked. And Avery's men were right along through this area, this low bottom, across Colt's Run that you just left across. We're in the shadow of the Colt Farm, the second oldest farm in the county. We told the story about Wesley Colt, and we can talk about that later if you're interested in following up on that personal story. But we're on the Colt property, Colt Run. There's an orchard here known as the Colt Orchard. And it ran with the flat side of the triangle. It was a triangle-shaped orchard, like so. The flat side of the triangle was right along where you see the fence. And then it converged slowly to its point right about at the barn. So we would have been standing in an orchard at the time, and the left of Avery's men would have been in the shade of that orchard. We know that Avery, Colonel Isaac Avery, who commanded them, even tied his horse to one of these orchard trees and took a nap under an apple tree. It must have been an apple orchard. For those of you who are not real familiar with context, I'll make this a lot quicker than I did earlier. The Union Army had rallied on Cemetery Hill at the end of the first day of the battle. And by the wee hours of the morning of July 2nd, their line had taken on the shape of a fish hook, like so. Okay? And at the bottom of the hill, your left where you see that watchtower. That was their right tower. The apex of their line was Cemetery Hill. The key to the Union position is straight ahead and somewhat blocked from your view today by woods that were not there at the time. That was the bulwark of the Union line, and that's where they had the majority of their guns passed, their artillery pieces, about 78 guns altogether. Then their line curved, and it became a shank on the fish hook. The long straight area known as Cemetery Ridge ran about a mile and a half. We call that more popularly the Union Center. And then the Union line would end by the morning of July 2nd, right about at the foot of Little Round Top, the eye of the hook, where we thread the fishing line. So the Union Army had a fish hook shaped line. Now we pointed out earlier that fish hook shaped lines were not unusual during the Civil War. Fish hook, J-shaped, U-shape were quite common. Lee operated under that type of line at Antietam. It allows you to ship troops within your line. You have concave-shaped lines. You can ship troops to points of emergency much quicker and more directly. Whereas if you're the attacker, like Lee was, he had the same shaped line, but he was on the outside. He had exterior lines. He had a smaller army stretched 6 miles, whereas the Union Army with a larger army was stretched 2.5 miles. The Union Army needed to do a better job of shifting troops within those interior lines than the Confederates would try to do, applying simultaneous pressure so they couldn't shift troops. Does that make sense? But when you're the attacker against interior lines, you have a basic understanding. Lee would have been aware of this. Meade understood it, that if you have exterior lines, you have to apply pressure everywhere so they can't shift troops. The one disadvantage of interior lines is, and there is only one as I can figure, the fire is eccentric. Everybody's firing out and not directly supporting each other. So if you're going to apply simultaneous pressure, and if the line breaks on one side, the center is hollow and you can pour in and attack the other side from the back side. If McClellan had applied simultaneous pressure against Lee at Antietam and applied simultaneous pressure on Lee's left at the Westwoods and on the right against the Birdside Bridge, Lee's line would have caved in. Lee knew that. Meade knew that. All the scenarios were known by both of them. So Lee's task was to apply simultaneous pressure. General Longstreet bore the largest corps of the Confederate Army. He was to attack the Union left, find it, and drive it in toward Ewell, not away from Ewell. Okay? Ewell, whose troops, Confederate troops, were opposite the curvature of the hook where we are, Ewell was to listen for Longstreet's gun. Longstreet was to be the main attack, And if Longstreet had been able to drive the Union Line in towards Ewell, presumably the sounds of the guns would have gotten louder and louder and louder. Ewell's attack was supposed to then originally take form in the form of a shape in the form of a demonstration, which he interpreted to mean firing artillery. Now, why would he want to do that? Why would you want at least a demonstration while the other side is being attacked, simultaneous pressure? You want them to respect every part of your line. And then Ewell was supposed to look for an opportunity to turn this demonstration into a full-scale attack. Opposite the Union Center, General A.P. Hill was to try to keep the Union Center pinned down by offering aid in Longstreet's attack and also perhaps even attacking directly on his own. So that was the scenario. You and I are opposite the curve of the hook, and this was a position maintained by Lieutenant General Richard Stoddard Ewell, who had the misfortune of covering a long, wide area. He was around the arc of the hook. You and I are right here, opposite the apex of the spearhead of the point. East Cemetery Hill is straight ahead. I've got a photograph taken at the time to show you just how commanding Cemetery Hill was. Today, with the businesses and the pavement and the visitor center and the mine saloon and the Battlefield Bus Tour Center and all the restaurants and Hope Park and various other things and trees, Cemetery Hill is almost camouflaged from your view. It doesn't bear resemblance to some of the quotes that I provided you all earlier on how commanding a position it was and how key it was to the Union position. That was taken on November the 19th, the day of Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, 4 months after the battle. Then here's a rare view, the only known photograph of East Cemetery Hill shortly after the battle. I'm going to pass this around so you can get a closer look at it. And as we get closer, you'll be able to see it even through the trees. So as we get from the broad to the specific now, we're part of the attack we're following is going to hit the very apex of the line, the very spearhead point of it, and it was to be carried out by Early's division. Early's division consisted of Hayes and Avery's brigade. Now Avery's 900 troops, we said, posted right along in here, running from left to right, about 900 men. 900 men, that would be 450 in the front rank, 450 in the back rank, with some spacing between the three regiments. We're talking about a foot spacing between each man. So 450 times 2, 900 feet wide. That's about 300 yards wide, is about how far they were. So they extended well out of your view. Over probably more towards the tennis courts in their left, going right up to about where these trees are. Now, as the morning dawned on July the 2nd, 1863, the Confederate troops who were lying here had to stay pinned to the ground. Imagine a Confederate soldier now in his gray or butternut uniform, pinned to the ground now in the shade of an orchard or further to our right out in the open sun. The reason he had to stay low was because Union sharpshooters on Cemetery Hill moved out and began to fire in this direction. You didn't want to stand up. Also, Union skirmishers, these are like tentacles on an insect. These are individuals who in small groups move out in front of the main line and they report back information they see. They trade shots with their opponents, skirmishers. So the Confederates would have sent out some skirmishers too. So bullets would have been flying out there. Colonel Isaac Avery ordered his North Carolinians to stay close to the ground. As they waited that morning, it got hotter and hotter and hotter. It got up to about 90 degrees, about 90% humidity. Imagine those wool uniforms. Also imagine not knowing what your fate is going to be. The soldiers spent the morning writing last-minute entries into their diaries, writing letters to home, finishing letters to home, penning notes of their name and state on their back and on their front, making sure that they would get a marker on their grave if they died. Some of them spent the morning, according to Randolph Kim, who was on Johnson's staff of Ewell's Corps, some of them spent the morning having prayer meetings and things like that. There were religious groups within the regiments as well. Now, men went about eating snacks, cleaning weapons, however they wanted to spend the morning, and listening to chickens in the background there. They also were treated to another interesting backdrop, and that was the sound of falling trees over on Culp's Hill. All morning long, timber! Some lumberjacks who were amongst Old Pap Green's New York regiments on Culp's Hill to your left got a bright idea to build these fortifications high enough that there would only be a small hole that they could look out of and put their rifles in and fire, and it would protect them. Union General Slocum, who commanded that hill over there, at first he didn't let the Union soldiers do that because he said they'll get too comfortable behind them and not want to move forward when I tell them. But finally he agreed to do that. And so all morning long the Confederates could hear trees falling all over. The same thing was happening up on East Cemetery Hill, straight ahead. And veterans' accounts that I've looked at that were in these regiments, this is where they were thinking about it. Stonewall Jackson is one of your things. The way they looked at it, they were going to have to assault the same hill that Ewell didn't allow them to assault 24 hours later after it was fortified. So it was bad. It would have been bad enough July the 1st, but as they saw it, it was going to even be worse, and their fears were heightened all day by the sound of falling trees. The Union soldiers were also taking out their bayonets and knives and sharpening the ends of the fallen branches and trees, pointing them out towards the Confederates. This is 20 years before barbed wire, but this is their form of barbed wire. It was called abatis, A-B-A-T-I-S, abatis. And it was like sharpened pencils, and Confederates could hear all of that going on throughout the morning. One Confederate said they were working like busy beavers up there all day. The Louisiana troops to my right in Early's division, over near where your cars are, they lay there all morning, and they must have been more antsy than these North Carolinians. According to Clark Champ's book on deploying the Yanks, it was part of the Time Life Civil War Times Illustrated version of the Civil War. Champ tells a story of how during the Valley campaign, Stonewall Jackson's troops did a rat of marching a year earlier in 1862, all up and down the valley. Those Louisiana troops, those five Louisiana regiments, were part of Jackson's old corps there. They were used to marching, and they moved quicker than most of Jackson's other men. And one day, Stonewall Jackson himself sought out their commander and said, "Those men really move." He said, "There's no straggling." And their commander said, "I never allow straggling." About that time, while he was boasting about his troops, someone started playing harmonica, and they all started dancing. And these Creoles, Creole would be mixed with... The Louisiana troops had a mix of French and Spanish. New Orleans was a port that allowed people to come in from all over the world. Now, there were 17 different countries represented in those five regiments. But there was that French, Hispanic mix to them, and they loved music. When harmonica played, they would stop and dance. And so Stonewall Jackson said, pretty lighthearted behavior. This was serious. What he thought was serious going. I found a couple of other accounts too, where at the drop of a hat they were dead. And I thought to myself, it must have been very difficult for them that whole morning to sit there pinned to the ground while bullets were flying around. So the morning continued to pass. Around 4 p.m., faintly in the distance, you could hear Longstreet's gun. These men have been broiling in the heat just about all day. Their attack couldn't start until the attack started on the other side. Remember, simultaneous pressure. Longstreet's cannonade started, and they heard it. Well, the Confederates would start their own cannonade from a place called Benner's Hill, and I want to move up to a better vantage point now to be able to see it.
We're moving from Wayne Benner's run right behind the Culp Farm up to the top of the hill on the tree line.
Water tower. We're going to move up to even a better vantage point in a few minutes, but that's the area where the Confederates started their demonstration. Someone asked another good question, too, about were there couriers to follow up on the information that, Longstreet's Guns had started up? And the answer is yes to that. There's fragmented information, but it seems as though there were routers on Lee's staff going back and forth communicating some of this. So the Confederates had to demonstrate. Now, once they demonstrated, your opponent, the Northern Army, had to know you mean serious business because you're far away from your home, far away from your base. You're not going to waste supplies way up here if nothing's going to follow. You see what I mean? So it was supposed to pin the Union troops down on this side so they wouldn't shift to the other end. The guns started to fire from there, and Avery's men down below were treated to some terrific fireworks. Some of the accounts indicate seeing streaks of light going over, and then Union guns from East Cemetery Hill, where you see the greenish-bluish water tower there. Primarily, it was a bald hill at the time. The guns on top of that hill were firing back. Colonel Wainwright's Union guns were firing at Major Latimer's Confederate guns. And they were lying down here in this low ground, watching the shells go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Even though it would have seemed sublime to them, it was brutal to Major Latimer's 18 guns. And there were an additional 6 guns placed within his 24 guns on Venner's Hill. Venner's Hill was the best place that Ewell could find in this area to bring artillery to bear against the Union line. But the hill was easily commanded by Cemetery Hill, which was close to, well, not quite, but almost 100 feet high. And the Union guns were able to just fire onto it and just tear it to pieces. They lost quite a few horses, quite a few men, and over half of their guns were disabled, their wheels broken, and they only could get a few guns out of there. Latimer himself was fatally wounded and died within a couple of weeks. General Ewell, who commanded this whole Confederate sector that would attack the arc part of the Union line, Lieutenant General Ewell said that the loss of Latimer, that there was no greater loss in the Confederate Army during the Gettysburg campaign. He thought very highly. Latimer was only 21 years old, and yet respected by men twice as many. They called him the boy major. Latimer was pinned to the ground by a horse, and he lay up there to die, but they got him out of there, only to die a couple weeks later. The shells were going back and forth, back and forth. Now, shells were also being fired from Gunner's Hill over to Culp's Hill, to my left. Those lumberjacks on Culp's Hill created enough of an opening that they were able to place 4 of Kinsey's guns. So there were guns being fired back and forth between Culp's Hill and Gunner's Hill. And in the attempt the Confederates were trying to make of a converging fire against the cemetery were, south and southern and western, the Confederates also were firing guns from A.P. Hill's Corps along Seminary Ridge west of it. So if the fishhook looks like this, if it looks like this, Confederates were firing all the way around the outer part of the arc. Does that make sense? Trying to create a converging fire on Cemetery Hill. At the same time, Lee was trying to capture the Peach Orchard, which was down here, so he could get a converging fire from that direction, too. Did you know Lee called the Peach Orchard the desired ground on the Union left? In his report, he called it the desired ground. He didn't even call Little Round Top the desired ground. He called the Peach Orchard the desired ground. And the reason is that one of the drawbacks of an interior line, a concave-shaped line, is that if you can get fire all the way around, if you can converge on the geometric center. And that's where Cemetery Hill had about 78 guns massed there. Add one other footnote just to maybe give you some food for thought. Lee's official report said that Longstreet's goal, his ultimate goal on the second day, was to reach the crest of the ridge. Well, that sounds kind of vague, doesn't it? Reach the crest of the ridge, I could be anywhere. But then he qualifies it and describes the ridge. He said it was masked with artillery. There was no other position on either side, Union or Confederate, that fit that description other than Cemetery Hill. So that's why Sickles' forward movement is so controversial. He overextended his line. That might, for some people, that would end the argument right there that he shouldn't have moved forward. But by taking the orchard, he took away a position Lee wanted which was critical to converging artillery fire. Well, Cemetery Hill won the day. They eliminated most of Latimer's guns, and they greatly quieted the guns firing from the west. Longstreet's attack, even though it had started late in the day, whether it was his fault, Lee's fault, Stuart's fault for not scouting the roads better, who knows, I'm not going to get into that one, but the attack started way too late. It started very close to sundown. It got dark then at 7:15 without daylight saving time. And the attack, the infantry assault, started about 4:15. So the window of opportunity was greatly closed. And Ewell's attack couldn't start until Longstreet's attack started, so the Confederates were really working against the clock. Ewell was told to listen for Longstreet's guns, demonstrate, and then when an opportunity arose, to turn that demonstration into a real attack. I'll say this and then we'll move on. The three divisional commanders under Ewell that would face this outer arc, Johnson opposite Culp's Hill, Early, which is the route of the division we're following, and then on from the west, Rose Division, those three divisions, those three commanders got together during the afternoon, and they made this agreement. They said, we're going to move out together. Jubal Early wrote to the Southern Historical Society in the post-war years that he resented anyone when they said that the attack was to be piecemeal from left to right. He said there was no piecemeal to it. He said we were all free to move out. All of Ewell's Corps was to move forward simultaneously against the full width of the arc. Simultaneously. He said that when he, Early, Johnson, and Rhodes got together, maybe they met somewhere in this area, we'll never know. When they met, they agreed that Johnson had rougher terrain in his front. His left was behind Benner's Hill on a place called Wolf Mountain. It was rocky, it was wooded. Most of his officers had to leave their horses by the straps because it was just too rocky to ride in. They had to cross a creek that was about waist high called Rock Creek. It was a mill pond to support McAllister's mill that had been dammed up. And because of those barriers, Rhodes and Early agreed that Johnson should start out first since he had rougher ground to cover. And since Early only had to cross open territory and Rhodes had to cross open territory, they would give him a head start and then they would move out and then all of them should come on par at the same time. Does that make sense? The opportunity occurred at about, to turn this into a real attack, occurred around 6:30 when a crisis occurred over the Union left, right in the area where the Pennsylvania Memorial was. Confederate attacks began to wrap around the peach orchard and extend down to the area where Pickett's assault would occur on the third day. Those attacks found a gap in the Union line. The Union advance troops out at the Emmitsburg Road were being pushed back. The point is, it was enough of an emergency that General Meade approved General Slocum's removal of 5,000 Union troops from the barb of the hook, Culp's Hill, to the Union left center. Remember we said interior lines give you that advantage? Well, it was a mass exodus of troops from one side to the other of the line. And as they moved out, they had to take their skirmishers with them and draw them back across Rock Creek, which is over to your right at the base of Culp's Hill. As they pulled those skirmishers back, guess what the Confederate skirmishers who were facing them did? Ah, something's going on. And they run back and tell Major General Edward Johnson, there's a mass withdrawal on our front. They just pulled 300 skirmishers out. Johnson took that as the opportunity to move. Early, down below here, heard Johnson's musketry fire increase over towards Culp's Hill. At that point, a bugle sounded over the duskiness of that evening around 6:30, 6:45. And when that bugle sounded, it set almost a frightening feel into a lot of the Confederates. And they rose to their feet in the dusk in this orchard, and then they started moving out. So we're going to start to follow Avery's maneuver out, eventually leading to East Cemetery Hill or Raffensperger Hill. So let's do that now, and let's make our way to the peak of the hill. Watch the ground carefully because there's some holes. Carolina, who was on the left of Avery's line. Archibald Godwin said that when they got to the top of the hill, which I always imagined Cemetery Hill, and I kept getting confused, I kept rereading it. So we got to the top of the hill, we realized the batteries that we were to assault, a battery is 6 Union guns, or four Confederate guns, depending on which army we're talking about. He said the batteries that we were to assault were considerably to our right. Okay, that's East Cemetery Hill over there, the area where the woods rise the highest. But what he's telling you is he didn't realize until they got right here that those guns were right over there. That gives you a soldier's perspective, doesn't it? He was so pinned to the ground all day long down below in that orchard. He had not even seen the position that he was trying to assault. Okay, so then they moved out diagonally. Now the reason they moved out diagonally, this far out, is because as soon as everyone rose to their feet, soon after the bugle wailed over the countryside, Hayes' Louisiana troops on your right where your cars are, they moved forward. But as they were getting ready to move forward and they dressed their lines extended and kept bumping out in this direction, which forced Avery's North Carolinians out here. So instead of being able to move straight ahead, they first had to move out here just to make room for Hayes on the right. Does that make sense? So we're now following the left fringe of this close to 300 yard wide line under Isaac Avery. We find a picture of this whole thing. It was getting dark. 6:45 to 7:00. Low daylight saving time. It got dark at 7:15, 7:30. It's starting to get dark. You'd have seen the sun setting in the west like a great red ball. You'd have smelled that sulfur smell of battle smoke, which was all over the field. Also, as you came up, if you're one of those vivid people who like to imagine all the details, as you came up out of here in the darkness, you were seeing running. Men in blue uniforms. These were members of the 33rd Massachusetts and the 44th New York. They might have come up this far. I know they came up this far where those Wilson rail fences were. They were Union skirmishers who tried to get closer and closer throughout the day and report back what they could see. They tried to keep the troops used to say pinned to the ground. So you would have seen their silhouettes in the darkness retreating back. They had done a masterful job all day and now they were falling back to the main line. Another scene you would have seen is on top of East Cemetery Hill, you would have begun to see streams of flames come out of the gun. You would have heard loud concussion noises and boom that would have echoed and reverberated down in the valley. A member of Hayes' staff, Isaac Seymour, said that they vomited. Perfect grape is what he said. Grape is like a... It's like these iron balls that are stuck in a can and they fire out like a shotgun shell effect. And that grape actually would explode on a time delay. So they would have seen some grape, perhaps some canister pouring out here, and sheets of flames coming out. That's good writing, isn't it? Vomiting out their destructive metal. Hopefully I've created enough picture that your imagination can take over. You're now following Avery's men diagonally towards the post and rail fence.
Stopping in another field between the post and the fence and the tree line at the ridge. The tablet right next to the stone wall in the field.
Causing simultaneous pressure on the curvature of the hook. Rose is attacking from the seminary. You can see right where he was. Can you see the green tarnished cupola of the seminary building? There would have been a red flag waving above it at the time, that time, because it had been turned into a hospital. Some of you know that it would flood in the 4 days of excessive rain after the battle, and a number of the men would drown in the basement. That's the same building that Buford, according to legend, used as a lookout tower and yelled down to Reynolds on the first day there's hell to pay, John. It's the same tower that General Lee would have walked up into to try to see as much of the Union line as he could on the second and then on the third day of the battle. But that's where Rhodes' attack was occurring. You and I are headed right towards the apex of the Union line. An interesting personal story is that as Avery's men moved out and his left eerie sound of that horn welled out over the countryside as they moved out. And some of them felt their doom was sealed, and then we described the backdrop for their forward movement. As they were moving out, maybe out of nervous habit, Colonel Isaac Avery was struggling with whether to ride in on his horse to see this old man, or go in on foot where you couldn't see as well, but you'd be less of a target. That was always the trade-off. And three times he untied his horse from the apple tree, and three times he retied. Finally decided to ride again. And as he rode in, from what we can gather, he moved along. Over here was the 57th North Carolina. And they extended down into where those woods are. Now, those woods weren't there. And they extended down into a very low bottom, Archibald Godwin talked about. And then in the middle was Colonel W.W. Kirkland's 21st North Carolina. And to the far right, beyond that initial strip of trees that you see, would have been Major Samuel M. Pate's 6th North Carolina. From what we can tell, Colonel Isaac Avery rode more over with them because that was the regiment he had just been promoted out of. He had helped create that regiment. He helped raise that regiment. He was close friends with Major Pate, who then was immediately placed in command of it. Avery was riding over there with his horse in this scene that I just described to you. And as his men were moving out in this dusk, a shell came off of Cemetery Hill and struck him. And then he fell from his horse down into where the football field is today. I don't know if you can see the goalpost from here. Can you pick up on the goalpost? As we walk a little bit further in just a minute, keep looking over, you might see the goalpost. It was right in that area where he fell from his horse, the horse pending to the ground. There was a small orchard there at the time. And as he was lying there, he reached into his haversack and got one hand out and pulled it out of his black bag. And on a dingy piece of Confederate notepaper, he wrote, "Major Tate, tell my father I died facing the enemy." He thought a lot of his dad. His dad was a robust fellow. From the letter that I read between Major Tate and Colonel Avery's father, his father was kind of a strong, masculine figure. He was a judge back in North Carolina, and it was important for Major Tate to know and to tell his father that Colonel Isaac Avery faced the enemy, and died facing the enemy. The attack turned over to that point to Colonel Archibald Godwin, who commanded this left regiment that I mentioned earlier. So he was in command of the whole thing. Now, before Tate fell, he gave an order. Avery Hill, he gave an order, but I'm going to discuss it our next stop. They marched usually in two parallel lines, as you know, a brigade line. 900 men, that would put 450 in each line, in the front line, and that would put 450 in the back line. They were usually a foot apart unless otherwise ordered to close in shoulder to shoulder. So if they did give the original foot, then 400... It would be, each soldier was about a foot wide. That's 450 feet. Plus, add another foot distance spacing between each one. That's 900 feet. 900 feet's about 300 yards. So that's about as scientific as we can get on it. And that does correspond with where that marker appears to be. Colonel Batchelder also owned a museum down there, too, that was later torn down. But either he was the owner or he spent a lot of time working there. I got this information from Pete Swinney. He's an older guy, older licensed battlefield guy. He retired years ago, but he's one of the local legends. All right, as they were moving out to this point, then what must have come into view after a few cannon blasts was that famous archway. I get chills looking at it. One of the most famous pictures of the battle appeared in Frank Leslie's Civil War Illustrated. It was the most well-known sight by civilians back home who bought that paper. A sketch by Edwin Forbes of Hayes' Assault of East Cemetery Hill. You've all seen this probably if you're interested in the battle at all. That's what you and I are following now. We're following that assault in this famous
sketch, if you could pass it around. I became real fascinated with that because as I was reading Bill Frazzanito's coffee table book for early photography at Gettysburg, Frazzanito said that the most commonly photographed spot on the whole battlefield immediately after the battle, by far, involved that Cemetery Hill gatehouse. Photographers were fascinated by it, and clearly so were sketch artists. More photographs were taken there than Little Round Top or any other place. And I brought out a few of those early photographs. Gutkunst, Alexander Gardner, Matthew Brady, all took pictures of it. So I began to think, what captured the artist's imagination that they would take so many pictures of it? This is just some conjecture. Hey, I'm dropping out of historical academia here for a minute, just using the fun part of history, imagination. You see what you think.
Are those taken from this side or from the other side?
Mostly from this side.
Mm-hmm. Is that tree right in front of us? I guess
wasn't. No, it wasn't there. Now, and as you get closer and closer, you'll see it more and more pronounced on top of that hill. I think what caught their imagination was that it looked a lot like the Arc de Triomphe. You've got a battle, you've got an arc on top of the hill, two armies are contesting for this critical hill. It seemed to crown the hill. And I looked a little bit further, it's kind of strange that such a grand piece of architecture would be sitting out there in a rural cemetery that only had a few people in it at the time. This was a German town on top of all that, and that's a Romanesque. It's almost as though it was made in advance for this event. And I think that's what might have crossed their mind, at least intuitively, and they kept taking pictures of it. I had someone maybe go a little too far with this. I had a person on the program say, well, there were some Louisiana troops on the right, and there were a number of Frenchmen there that came up through New Orleans. Frenchmen, Arc de Triomphe, maybe that looked just like the Arc de Triomphe to them. But we may be grasping for straws if we reach too far with this. But there it is, crowning the hill. Did you know that in Roman times, Julius Caesar was one of the first to create arches like this? And typically, you would build an archway to represent a campaign that you had won as a military figure, and then you had a sculptor sculpt into the side of it, the battle. Napoleon did that with the Arc of Triumph in 1814 to symbolically point out his campaign victory. There was at least one Union regiment there, the 153rd under the skirmish line was under Clyde Miller. So he fired at them, they spotted them, and it must have been right in here, according to the Confederate accounts. They stopped, and you would have seen a sheet of flame all along the line. You'd have seen the muskets emptying before the skirmish line. And better than continued moving forward. Miller set up the 153rd skirmish line behind. Right here. I remember when the first time I came out to try to find it, and I was groping around, and there it was. It's one of those that hasn't been rebuilt by the Park Service. You can see the remnants of it there. Some of the same rocks that the Union soldiers leaned on when they fired, and Confederates stepped over when they pursued. Archibald Godwin, who was on the left of Avery's command, said that they descended in a very low, marshy bottom. And I left back there two springs ago, and it was so marshy that my legs at one point disappeared all the way up to here, and I learned for the first time what quicksand must have been like. I got scared. I started screaming. I was running around my ears. I was mud. It was really low. He also said that they had to surmount three stone walls. They're all down there.
Wow.
They're all there. And he talked about how that, all these obstacles slowed down that rapidity of success that makes a maneuver like this have a better chance of success. And you can see why. Well, they were maneuvering down through that. Now, after they were able to move the skirmishers back, they continued executing a maneuver that I've waited to this point to tell you about. And that is they started executing a right wheel. From the very beginning, Hayes' brigade extended out far enough that Avery had to move out diagonally. He said that a little bit earlier, right? So it became apparent that if they were going to attack Cemetery Hill at some point, they had to cut back diagonally, right? So they made a right wheel, which is very difficult to do, especially under fire. So they would have started doing this.
moving slowly to conform to the base of East Cemetery Hill. And they would have seen the Union cannons up there on top of the hill. It would have been all far more visible then than it is now. From what we can figure, Colonel Archibald Garwin says that Avery gave the command to do the right drill. So that command must have been given early on, before he was mortally wounded. So they were executing it almost from the point of the road to the first cross all the way up to here. So it's been a slow, steady, swinging maneuver as they're trying to conform to the base of the hill. There would be Union guns off to the left who would harass them. We'll move on to our next stop and take a look at Stevens Knoll.